It's episode 4 of season 2 of the Doctors in Litigation, the L Word podcast. It's June 2024. Hi, everybody. It's Gita Pensa, and I'm back. Today, we are going to talk about some mindset work with an introduction to mindfulness in litigation. And of course, you can also use these concepts in life. Now, if you're new around here, go back to season 1. This episode will still be here later, but start there for the foundation. And here in season 2, we are jumping all over the place to different litigation and coaching adjacent topics. So yes, today, mindfulness. Now, even if you feel that mindfulness is an annoying buzzword these days, something that just makes you want to roll your eyes, the truth is that there is a wealth of research to support a positive effect of mindfulness on the mental health and overall well-being of physicians and other healthcare workers. And this is really well documented in spheres like burnout and job satisfaction. And it also definitely can help with the stressors of litigation too. I introduce mindfulness as one of many different cognitive tools for physicians and other clinicians that I'm working with during litigation. And there are many, many ways that you can think about mindfulness. And the purists are going to say that mindfulness is an ancient practice of finding present moment awareness and non-judgmental observation of your own thoughts and feelings. But it's also the basis of many cognitive behavioral techniques and really the essence of a lot of what we do in coaching and thought work. So to me, the most basic way of thinking about mindfulness is focusing your attention on one thing and taking yourself off of autopilot. Focusing your attention on the thing that you are doing or the thought that you are thinking, to the exclusion of chatter or runaway thoughts or rumination or doom scrolling. I mean, most of us are feeling like our attention is all over the place these days. And to me, it feels almost luxurious sometimes to just take 3, 5, 10 breaths, where all I'm thinking about are those breaths, just the air going in and out. It is so simple, and it takes practically no time as a reset. And this is the first baby step that you can take into learning about mindfulness. So the basis of all of this is that your mind can really only pay attention to one thing at a time. We attention shift very, very rapidly, especially these days with all the distractions coming at us rapid fire. Our brains are getting really good at switching focus rapidly because our brains get good at what we think over and over and what we do with our minds over and over. When you have a thought more than once, you are practicing that thought. When you try to pause and reflect before yelling at someone, you're practicing pausing and reflecting in that circumstance. So whatever your mind does, your mind is practicing doing. To me, mindfulness is, for the mind, like physical exercise is for the body, in that you can do even a tiny bit, and it's going to be an improvement over where you were. You do not have to be an Olympic athlete to benefit from a little bit of exercise. And likewise, you do not have to be a Zen master. You don't have to be a meditation master for mindfulness to have a positive impact on your life. Every little bit that you add into your life can have a positive effect on your well-being. And that non-judgmental observation of your own thoughts, this sort of scientific observation without judgment of what is happening in there, we talk a lot about that in coaching, and it's a very important skill to cultivate. It is that metacognition, thinking about your own thinking, that just serves as the basis for any kind of change in our mental constructs. But okay, a few seconds of mindfulness can just serve as a pause and a reset when you're spinning out of control, or if you're in danger of reacting to a stimulus in an unprofessional or an unkind way. And again, like exercise, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And it feels weird and clunky at first, and you might not be great at it, but it is in the persistence and practice that you actually improve. So in that spirit, before we get started in talking to our guest today, I have two quick exercises for you to try. I promise you they're not too hokey and no one else will know you're doing them. And, you know, why not give it a shot? The first I offer to people as a tool to use when you need a very quick reset. And yes, it focuses on the breath. It is called a stacked breath. So what I'd like you to do is, yes, I am going to do it with you. I'm going to ask you to take an inhale. And when you inhale, I really want you to do it from your belly. Like I want you to expand your belly as we breathe, like you're blowing up like a beach ball in there. And then when you get to the top of that slow, deep inhale through your nose, I should say, I want you to actually stack another inhale on top of it, again, through the belly. I mean, we're all doctors, and I know that you're breathing in your lungs, but there is, you know, just like babies do, there is a natural up and down motion of the belly when you're not trained to sort of suck in your core. So let that belly loose, feel it expand as you inhale. And there is a method behind this because what we know is when you increase your intra-abdominal pressure, what happens? You increase your vagal tone a little bit, right? So you're trying to deactivate that sympathetic nervous system. You're trying to increase your vagal tone a little bit. And so do it once with me, the inhale, and then stack an extra inhale on top of it. And now slowly exhale over a count of 8 to 10, whatever you can manage, while you let your shoulders and your upper back just sink down with relaxation as you do it. And then do it one more time without me talking quite so much. You do an inhale, stack the breath, expand that belly, and then let it all out. I don't care if it's coming out of your nose, your mouth, or whatever. I just want you to pay attention to the air moving in and out, the pace at which it's going, and letting your shoulders relax at the end. Whenever you find in your day that you are getting a little bit overwrought, overwhelmed, angry, something isn't going your way, you're very frustrated, this is a really nice reset. It focuses your attention somewhere, it keeps you from sort of spinning out, it relaxes you a little bit. You know, you can do it with eyes open or closed. If you can do it eyes closed and, you know, no one's around to make fun of you, try it, because you'll find at the end of it that you do have a little more mental focus and clarity, and then you can come back to whatever it was that you were doing in that moment. Okay, second exercise. Pick an activity that you have to do at any time during the day, some sort of boring, banal activity like washing the dishes. And when you're washing the dishes, I want you to actually say to yourself that you're going to practice some mindfulness while you're washing the dishes. And if you're washing a dish, just tune in to the feel of the water and the suds and the circular motion of your scrubbing and the pressure and the feel of the sponge, the change in the appearance of the dish. I know it seems nuts, but give your mind a chance to practice paying attention to something in detail and allowing a really deep sensory experience. And you will find that act to be very calming, if not yet gratifying. So pick any activity like that that you normally do during the course of your day and just pay attention to what you're doing. I often do it when I'm getting my coffee maker ready. I'm putting in the grounds and smelling the grounds. It's, you can do it for really anything. But take this activity on as a deliberate practice of, I'm practicing getting this deep sensory experience. Try to use all your senses. This will actually help you later as you're cultivating more of a mindfulness practice, but it is something that you can do when you were already doing the thing. It helps to take you out of autopilot. It's a skill you're cultivating of bringing yourself out of autopilot and into just doing the thing that you are doing. It's a great, easy place to start. And even though it seems silly, try to suspend your judgment of that at the moment and just practice it, because your brain gets better at whatever it practices. And then you can expand what you're doing in the future. So without further ado, let me share with you my conversation with Douglas Morgan, who has been a defense attorney for decades at this point. He is an expert practitioner of mindfulness and meditation, although he makes the point often that you don't need to be an expert for this to help you. And he works with his defendants often in trying to cultivate mindfulness in their approach to litigation. using it in deposition, using it as they're moving forward before testifying at trial. Doug cares deeply about the well-being of his physician defendants, and he has become a friend of mine. So I hope you enjoyed this introductory conversation about mindfulness in litigation. Doug, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about mindfulness in litigation. And that it sounds heavier than it is going to be, I think.
Yeah, it probably is. And thank you for having me. Certainly, it plays a pretty solid role in my practice and in my representation of my clients.
So you've been a defense attorney, a trial attorney for well over 30 years, and you have defended hundreds upon hundreds of healthcare workers. We're going to get a little more into like, what is mindfulness? Because it's turned into, I think, a bit of a catchphrase, buzzword kind of thing that people want to roll their eyes at. But I want to set the stage by just talking about how you introduce the idea of it to your clients, to the people that you're defending who are highly distressed and sort of in the throes of this storm.
I mean, just for a little background, how even arrived at this approach, which by no means was by design. Very early on in my career in representing an obstetrician in an obstetrical case, after his deposition, he told me a story about someone else who had represented him. He was very nervous, as you would expect him to be, and said that this other attorney had basically told him in response, "I'll take care of everything, just relax, don't worry." And he was very clear that that wasn't a help. Very early on, I had always put a big emphasis on trying to get my clients to be at ease or more at ease than they were, which not only makes it a healthier experience for them, somewhat of a learning process, actually, and ultimately, in terms of testifying, it just made them perform better. It was over the course of time that this really evolved in trying to weave into my meetings with them, with prep sessions, getting the idea as to what the source of their anxiety was. It's just not one thing. It's just not, is there going to be a bad outcome? It's just not, oh, I feel terribly for this patient and his or her outcome. It can just be multiple things. What I've tried to do over the course of time is to get them focused to not so much on the end result, not so much on what's happened in the past or even what's happening in their practice, but rather getting them to focus on what is happening now. What are we doing now? What are we talking about? What are we working on now? And when they're in that position of focusing on the present without any judgment about what's happening now, that's where they'll start to relax and they'll start to really kind of understand what they need to do. And hopefully it carries over into their practice, where rather than being stressed while they're being pulled in 100 different directions, that they're able to focus better on what they're doing at the moment and approaching things that way.
I am not a student of mindfulness. I try to practice a little bit of mindfulness. I think for the uninitiated, and there may be people listening to this who are like real practitioners of mindfulness. I think you are a practitioner of mindfulness. You've been using it in your own life for a long time. I know you've traveled to Nepal and done all sorts of really cool stuff with it.
You don't have to do to have a mindfulness practice.
Correct. And I think practice is probably the operative word. So do I have a mindfulness practice? Probably not, but I do try to incorporate it in some ways into my own life and into coaching. So I want to talk about the version of sort of mindfulness light that I will use with people to sort of introduce them to this idea. And I want to ask if this jibes with you, because it does seem to help people. And it is that thinking about cognitive neuroscience, our brains cannot actually focus on more than one thing at once. We think we can. We try to multitask, but actually our brains can really only pay attention to one thing at a time. And when you are paying attention to what is happening in the present moment, you cannot also be ruminating about all of the things that have been happening and worrying about all the things that are going to happen, because you are paying attention to what is happening at this moment. Does that sound like a good place to start?
It's absolutely a good place to start. And that's really just it. And we live in society where multitasking is really required and encouraged. You're asking people to do something that's entirely unnatural to them. As the saying goes, basically multitasking is doing a lot of things in a mediocre way. Mindfulness kind of gets you out of that framework. I guess if there's some definition, it's seeing things for what they are or as they are without the judgment, which is a big help, certainly in stressful situations, but really in any situation. In doing that, it's trying to prevent the past from interfering, some concern about the future from interfering, and really seeing the present as it is, you know, without the judgment and without the interference from the past or the future.
A lot of basic, I think, redirection of people who are feeling lost, who are feeling like they've had their life sort of sucked away by litigation. For me, in medicine, starting to actually pay attention to what I was doing at work and the meaning behind it, and it was sort of imbued with, I was doing important things at work. I just couldn't see the meaning of it. I couldn't really pay attention in the moment of caring for a patient or using these high-end skills that I developed over time. I just sort of lost this appreciation for what I was doing. I was on autopilot. And it wasn't bringing my attention back to the fact that this is what I'm doing right now, and it has great meaning. That I found very, very helpful. It's the part about the non-judgmental. It's a high bar even these days, I think, to ask people to pay attention to what is happening in the moment. And it's an even higher bar to then say, okay, but now I don't want you to react to it. I just want you to observe it. So how do we get to that part?
There's a difference between reacting and responding. And that difference is when you have the judgment involved about, oh, well, now I got to see this patient, or I've already seen 32 today. Now I got to see a walk-in. Something like that, already you're starting off with this judgment about what is about to take place and a concern. And that's the part where instead of being reactive to the situation, being responsive, because it's that layer of judgment that is really the part that creates the stress, whether it's healthcare or really in any field. Look, does this happen overnight? No, it doesn't. Mindfulness or meditation is like any other exercise. If you're going to the gym once a month, you're not going to make a lot of progress. If you're going more often, you're going to make progress. And it's the same thing. It's really developing a practice and kind of understanding how it works, how it makes you feel. And a lot of people get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And the beauty of it is that it's just not sitting meditating. It's something that you can access any part of the day, even in a fast-paced emergency department or OR suite or anything else. That's the part that becomes very helpful.
Now, there are formal mindfulness-based stress reduction programs. And I know you have done, I think, retreats, right, with the creator, Jon Kabat-Zinn, of that program. There is actually pretty good evidence that not just regular participants, but also doctors that participate in these 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction courses score higher on standardized psychological tests. They report higher quality of life. They report reduction in burnout symptoms. If you don't have 8 weeks to participate in one of these programs, but you still want to try to start to understand this, try it on, see if it feels like something that you would want to get better at in the first place. Like, help us understand, what is square one? Where do you actually start?
Square one is just plain being open to it from the beginning. And quite frankly, from the start, not trying to understand it, just simply doing it. You don't have to go to an 8-week course. You don't have to go to a retreat. It can start with an app, and there's many of them. There are places online that you can go, or just simply by yourself, finding a place that's quiet and focusing on your breathing. And when your mind wanders, bringing it back to your breathing. That's a good place to start. Once again, approaching it in a way that there's nothing to be attained. Though you think you want to attain something,
come on, Doug. Everything is goal-directed with us.
Believe me, as a trial attorney, everything's goal-directed with us as well. But that's kind of the, not so much a mystery, but a feature of it is that it gives you the space that you aren't doing something. What you're doing is you're finding a space where the past is in the past, the future is in the future. You're just there now. You're focused on your breathing. And that once your mind wanders, you bring it back to your breathing. Again, without being hard on yourself or saying, why can't I do this? Because everybody's mind wanders. And you find after a while that you do develop mental strategies to bring yourself back to what's happening now, instead of being detoured into what's going to happen or what's happened in the past and how it's affecting me now. And even that is a good place to start. And that's why I jumped in saying you don't have to go to Nepal, which is a whole other reason, quite frankly. But it's that simple.
Even though we don't have a goal really in mind, the carrot for this is that eventually it may help you reduce your stress, improve your focus, improve your ability to perform in a given moment without distraction or reactivity, and bring you some peace.
Absolutely. And whether you're practicing medicine, you're an attorney, how many athletes at this point? Phil Jackson had the entire Chicago Bulls in a mindfulness practice, and they're pretty successful. The military endorses it. So this is something that's pretty tried and true. Though we call it mindfulness, the reality is it's been around for about 2,600 years, something that people do practice day in and day out and has its benefits. But again, it's not like the ads that you'll see on the internet, better abs in 30 days or something like that. And quite frankly, if you approach it that way, it's not going to work. So that's why kind of the key is finding this place where you're focused on now. Nowhere to go, nothing to do, nothing to attain. And that's the practice.
Now, I like the way that you describe it. And I like the way that you say that you don't have to go to Nepal and you don't have to do it in a specific way and you don't have to go to a course to do it. I've said before, I'm sort of a mutt in my coaching approach, but also I'm not a purist in really any of these things, which makes it easier to dabble actually and then to adapt it and to find a way that it works for you. And then I offer that to other people as maybe you can try this. If you don't have time to go to an 8-week retreat or anything like that, perhaps you can try these methods. I haven't said this before on the podcast, but my father was a monk. My father was a Hindu monk who had a regular meditation practice, which I have tried on and off to emulate. I'm really not consistent with it. But the understanding and the appreciation of the ideas as something that other people really can do with practice and persistence is something that I don't push back against. I think that there are people listening who don't have that exposure and haven't seen anyone with that degree of benefit from a regular practice of it. So I know from watching people and from my home like that, it does help people. It's just that I hadn't figured out how to make it work for myself. And it probably really wasn't until I was really struggling with certain things in litigation. And when mindfulness or the idea of mindfulness came into my life, it was really as a method to try to learn how to reset when I became really stuck in a rabbit hole of rumination, when I could not get out of these cycles of negative thoughts. As soon as I was able to learn how to observe that I was having the thoughts and then try to pattern interrupt in some way, that was the mindfulness moment. That was when if I can stop what I'm doing, I see what I'm doing here. I see, mind, I see what you're doing. We're going to redirect. We're just going to redirect. We're going to breathe for a couple of seconds. Just pay attention. Do not think about anything else except your breathing, which gives you something to focus your attention on. And then after a minute or so of that, I was able to sort of move back into, okay, I don't need to be in that hole. Give me some examples of how mindfulness has helped some of your clients in litigation.
Well, I don't use the word mindfulness, but I will give them illustrations that are built right into the practice of medicine. And typically when I see someone, I'm speaking to someone who I can tell is not listening, that they're focused on what horrible thing is going to happen in the future. Usually I'll say something like, if you're not a surgeon, have you done a rotation in the OR? I have. And in the beginning of these surgeries, that there's a timeout. Yeah, no, I've been part of that timeout. And that timeout is to just focus for a moment on that moment and making sure correct patient, correct limb, correct surgery, and just to reorient. Yeah, I know that. This is our timeout. And I kind of go from there, number one, to kind of normalize what we're doing for them, that this is something that your own profession recognizes. You may not know it as such, but this is what your profession does. To tell them that this is what we're working on now, that I know what happened to this patient, it does haunt you, but we're here now. I know you're afraid of what's happening in the future. It hasn't happened, nor will it probably not happen. We're here now. So let's talk about now what we can do moving forward in working together, whether it's preparing for a deposition, preparing for trial, and just to give them something to orient. And what that does is help them put it into perspective a little bit. A lot of them say, boy, okay, yeah, you're right. And kind of do what you did is not eliminate the stress, because it won't ever eliminate the stress, but it will help you identify when you're perseverating about a certain thought or fear. And when you identify it, then it's something that can become manageable. And then you can return to whatever it is, your breath, your task at hand, and bring you back to what's happening now, as opposed to some horrible verdict that may not ever happen in the future. So that's really how I will get them started.
I think using deposition as an example, the moment when you're actually in the seat, having to answer the questions, having to focus on the question that's being asked, having to choose your words, I can imagine that having a pretty strong mindfulness practice could be helpful for a defendant in that position.
Absolutely. And it's usually before events like giving a deposition, or when they're about to take the stand at a trial, where we'll go through and I'll remind them of the timeouts that take place in the OR, and that this is our timeout. So we're in a space that's not worried about what's happened in the past or the fact that they're about to give a deposition or give testimony. And we just talk and use that space to remind them how hard they've worked to get to this point, how much energy that they've devoted to preparing, to let them feel at ease. And even with the first couple of questions of a deposition, I tell them, your adrenaline's going to be running. First few questions are going to be, for the most part, kind of straightforward questions. Your name, your address, where you went to school. Take a breath, deliver all these responses very deliberately, and take your time and set the pace early on and use this time to get yourself settled. The harder questions will come later and you'll be prepared, but use this time to get yourself settled. So that's really my approach.
I think some people use the language of like setting an intention, or I like this idea of setting an intention when you're going into deposition of like this, I am going to be mindful, because honestly, the opposite side of that coin is inattentiveness, mindlessness, autopilot, and bad things can happen when you are on autopilot and giving a deposition.
One of the questions, I know I've said this before, that when I hear a question from a client start off, what if, that signals to me, all right, not quite a real question, more an expression of anxiety. Well, what if I don't remember this response? What if he asks me this? I'm quick to remind him, look, number one, in the history of the law, no one's given a perfect deposition. So this is not about perfection. Number two, with each of these questions, you take them one at a time and address those questions. You're going to be fine by taking them one at a time. But if you're worried about a question that's going to occur 10 minutes, 20 minutes from now, and you're just anxious about when he's going to get to it, when she's going to get to it, then you're not doing what you need to do in the most immediate moment when another question is being asked. Those are things that help review for them.
That is very, very good advice. I mean, I think that there is some aspect when you're in the hot seat of thinking to yourself, why did they ask that question and where is this likely to go immediately after this? But if you're not really paying attention, if you're not really in that moment and you're worried about something else that's much more abstract, you're not going to pick up on that.
Which once again, that's why I encourage them one question at a time, listen to that. And even with an attorney who tries to pick up the pace to throw them off so they don't have time to think, even reminding them, the attorney doesn't set the pace. There's no jury sitting here. There's no one timing you. Take your time. If you feel the questions are coming too rapid fire, think about your response a little bit. Slow things down and do it at your pace. I think all these things are helpful that they can take a little bit of control of the situation, but also to give them the time that they need at that point to focus on that question. And once they get to relax a little bit and feel more comfortable with the process, that's when they perform well.
Right. Anything that makes you less reactive and more responsive, as you said earlier on, I think is a good tool to have. And we all have lots of emotions running around. We've got lots of feelings. And the question always is, like, what's going to drive the bus in this moment? And what you describe, I interpret as the ability to bring yourself to a clear-headed state, to be present in the moment where your anxiety is not driving the bus, your fear is not driving the bus, your anger is not driving the bus. You are driving the bus. Like, you and your higher mind, your wisest mind, is going to drive this bus.
And that's something that I will be pretty blunt with them about, is that when it comes to decision-making, before we go into a deposition, certainly before we go into trial, and I hear someone who's talking from a point or place of anxiety, I remind them that we're not going to make good decisions if we make them based on anxiety. We're going to make good decisions about what we need to do and good judgments where it's coming from really a settled place of reason. That does sink in. Sometimes it takes a few times, but it does eventually sink in. And that's the difference, again, between being reactive or responsive. And it's that reactive layer that is just chock full of anxiety, no matter who you are.
You do at some point, I feel like, need to be able to switch, because you're going to feel anxiety. Like, we're not saying you shouldn't feel anxiety. You will feel anxiety. You will feel fear. Your mind is going to go places. What I feel like the practice, coming back to this neuroscience thing, is that what practicing mindfulness does is make you more agile. It makes you able to sense, okay, anxiety is taking over. Wait a second. I'm going to step back and I'm going to change who's driving the bus in this moment. That practice, like being able to like redirect your thoughts, to take a breath, to reset. The practice comes into place because your brain develops it as a skill. The more we have the neuroplasticity to allow ourselves to get faster at that, to get better at it, to recognize it. And then when you are in the hot seat and you can feel these other emotions taking over, it is much easier to move into a place where you're making these decisions with wisdom and with clear eyes. And I think that just in general, it plays over into a certain degree of emotional responsiveness and emotional agility that serves people well in most of their other spheres of life.
No doubt. I mean, the point that you make about the neuroplasticity is that the science confirms through MRI studies of people who have a mindfulness practice that over the course of time, the degree of neuroplasticity grows. It's not as though you hit a plateau at some point. You literally can get better and better at it as time goes by. Again, won't happen overnight, but if you put in the time, you become more agile, become more solid, which is the way I put it. That's ultimately what you want. And the crazy thing is, to bring you back to what you're asking before, that's what you want. But when you're sitting, it's really to attain nothing. But those are the results.
Those are the byproducts. That is true. You will gain everything by pursuing nothing.
You got to love it. Gaining everything by pursuing nothing.
Oh, this has given us a lot to think about. I think people can learn how there's so many overlaps between mindfulness, meditation, gratitude practice. I think all of these are just really trying to get us to pay attention to our lives, and that there's more going on in them than this lawsuit and the fear and anxiety that it brings into our life. That is in our life, but our life is also beyond that and happening in all sorts of other ways, big and small. There is some degree of solace in paying attention to those other things, that they're still happening, your life is still happening, the good things are still happening. We just develop this lens where we can't see them. And so this is bringing the lens back to focus on other things that aren't so scary.
And that's for anybody. Healthcare provider is going to make you more balanced. With these lawsuits, depending on the case, they last anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And there's a lot of life that goes on in 3 to 5 years. If you have kids, particularly younger kids, there's a lot going on that you want to be part of with your career, with your spouse or significant other. things that you just want to do. And if you're spending your time waking up at 4 a.m. concerned about this horrible verdict in the future that's more likely not even going to happen, you're missing out on a lot. And the things that you're missing out on are now, which is why it's so important that your focus is on now, uninterrupted by the past, uninterrupted by the future, seeing now for what it is or as it is.
I love that. Well, on that note, I will say thank you very much. In this moment, I have deep gratitude for your coming to talk to people about this.
Likewise, I'm deeply grateful for having me. Thank you very much.
All right, everyone, that is it for June 2024. Thank you again to our guest, Douglas Morgan, medical defense attorney with McCarthy, Booley, Berry, and Morgan. He's licensed in Massachusetts, Maine, Rhode Island, and New York. Now, before we go, Doug mentioned some apps that you could use to get started with a mindfulness practice. Two that he's familiar with are the JKZ app for Jon Kabat-Zinn. That's Jon Kabat-Zinn's meditation app. Kabat-Zinn is the creator of the original mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And Doug also likes the Plum Village app, which offers meditations around the Buddhist teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. And by the way, if you are looking for some easy introductions to Eastern philosophy around mindfulness, the teachings of the famous Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh are a great place to start. I can put these apps and also how to spell his name if you want to read some of his other books in the show notes. Other popular apps to try to get things started are things like Headspace, Insight Timer, or the 10% Happier app. I have no affiliation with any of them. I have tried all of them. I would say just to pick one that you like and use it as a teaching tool for yourself, because you also want to cultivate the ability to shift into that mindful frame whenever you need to, independent of an app. But they are wonderful tools to introduce you to a really wide range of new things to just experiment with. So remember, just practicing a tiny bit daily is enough to give you some benefit. And just like exercise, once you see the benefits, you just might want to do more. So see you next month.